Good morning. I am Pat McDade, and I am an alcoholic. And thank you for your invitation. Introduction. All right, so we know I'm already stumbling. It's the nerves. No matter how long I'm sober, how often I do this, that first 5 minutes is like getting grounded in who's giving the talk. You know, is it God inspired or is it me trying to prove to you that I need to be here, I belong here, and that I'm okay. And the first two were right. The okayness is always in process. Anyway, we said the Serenity Prayer, okay, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I should do it again. you know, I remember, that happens to me all the time because I'm zoned. All right, my sobriety date is March 18th, 1988. I sobered up in the Cleveland area in Ohio. I have a sponsor whom I work with, and I sponsor people whom work with me and I work with and whom I learned so much from. I'm married to my first husband for 44 years, which is a benefit of the program. It's a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and his endurance too. When I arrived into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea what was wrong with me or what I was getting into. And talk about a leap of faith. And, you know, I was at such an emotional bottom that I had no choice. Someone offered me this solution, and I had tried everything else within my capability to drink properly and not be that tornado whirling through lives. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York. I'm one of six. There was active alcoholism in my home, but it was a good home. And I'll tell you, a lot of perceptions of what it was like have changed since I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't know I was loved when I got here. And as I look back on it and experiences in sobriety with my siblings and all, I found out I was, but not enough. And I can remember my mother saying to me one time, "You are so needy. You wear your heart on your sleeve." You know, I go, "Oh, drama, you know, wonderful stuff." And I didn't get it. She'd say, "You have to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral." See, it was all about me even back then. And I had no idea. You know, I can't tell you how grateful I am for the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in the rooms that have taught me so much and enlightened me so much about me. I'm an alcoholic, and good stuff. I had my, as I remember it, I mean, we used to have cream de mint at Christmas, a little bit of liqueur glass of that, the kids did, and but my first drink and was when I was 18 years old. I grew up in New York, and 18 was the legal drinking age. And so I had my first drink. And, you know, as I was driving down here, I was thinking, it did for me, that first drink did for me, what alcohol did for me for a long time. And I progressed then immediately and looked for opportunities so I could have a good time. And alcohol did that for me. And blacking out started pretty early. I went to a fall weekend at Cornell when I was about 20, and it's where I was introduced to Scotch, and it was a debacle. I mean, the fraternity house, we were sloshing around in booze on the floor, okay, and they had, unbeknownst to me, this is in retrospect because so much has come back. Peter, Paul, and Mary, the singing group, were just getting started. This is in 65. And the folk era was coming in and all. And they were singing for the entertainment at this weekend in Cornell. And we got there, and we were sitting on bleachers. And I was really drunk. By the way, this was a blind date, okay? I mean, that's whatever. And boy, he didn't know what he got into. So I'm sitting on the bleachers, and they're singing and all of a sudden I slip down through the bleachers. Okay, and I'm down, and I was passing out, basically, down under the bleachers. And nobody bothered to come and get me, as I remember it, you know? And bottom line is, it was supposed to be such this great experience, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, I'm in this deal, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I took the drink, and the drink took me. And that was to happen off and on through my sobriety. I moved to Washington, D.C. when I was 22, and we lost my brother when I was 22, my oldest brother, and it really tore the family up, especially my parents. And he was a Marine and naval aviator, and the plane crashed, and he died. And he was kind of the guy. He was the oldest one. He was the god of the family, and it crumbled my parents. It was very, very sad. And I'm saying that because it leads into meeting my husband. I went to Washington D.C. and went to an after-hours party on a Friday night. Because when the bars close and wash down there with the young people, they start, they move to somebody's home, you know, to continue. And I'd been invited, oh, lucky me, and was there. And I was dancing with somebody who kept telling me I looked just like Shirley MacLaine, okay? You know, this was, and he just couldn't let it go. So I was attracting really normal people. I looked in at the doorway, and it was about 4 a.m. of this apartment, and there stood this really good-looking, dapper, fun-looking guy. And back then we wore suits and ties and skirts and all that when we were out. And he winked at me. And I went, aha, you know, there he is. And we talked into the night and all, and it was good. And we went down to the parking lot, and I'm driving a little Volkswagen Beetle, and I passed a Corvette, and I said, whoa, that's some car. And he said, I'll show you a car. And not in that attitude, though. He said, let me show you my car. Okay, I heard, I'll show you my car. And he took me over, and it was a Mercedes 230 SL. I had not the foggiest idea what it was, and I hadn't seen one before. And I just wasn't impressed with it. But he called me again anyway. And we went out, we dated and all, and married. And we started having our family. And my drinking was already a problem. I had passed out a couple of times when I was with him and all, but he didn't really worry about it because everybody was partying. And we started having our family, and I had a very bad incident when on St. Patrick's Day. I had a 5-month-old son in a crib, in the bedroom, and I got terribly, terribly drunk and realized that I could not care for him. And I realized that when I was cleaning up after the party and emptying the glasses, you know, down my throat, and I went to open the apartment door, and we had a chain lock on it and all, and it was on, and when I opened the door, I opened it so hard that it pulled the lock off the door, the chain, it broke and all. And that's not my way. You know, alcohol, it didn't open right the first time, so, you know, you give it a yank. And that really hit me like a ton of bricks. And I, right that night, went into controlled drinking. And I was so afraid of what I'd done that I had that kind of anger and power in me. And so for the next several years, I controlled my drinking by telling him when he was allowed to drink and not allowed to drink, because one of us had to be sober, and basically counting my drinks and all. And that didn't last too long. I was, you know, doing the suburban housewife stuff, had nice friends, you know, we were just rolling along. Bill had been, you know, promoted into another position. But I just had an itch that I couldn't scratch, just an itch that I couldn't scratch. And nothing was enough, everything was too much. You know, I just, this inside situation that I had, that I remembered alcohol could cure. And so I picked up the drink again and went on, and it started disrupting our home. My the kids were starting to be affected. I'm maintaining. I don't know how I did it. That's the thing. We've got so much strength in us, and the ability to do the next right thing until we go down to cross that line and alcohol became my master. I started being escorted out of parties, Bill taking me home. I started drinking by myself. The kids, I'd sit them down. We had a counter island in the kitchen, and I had the four stools and the four kids lined up, you know, putting dinner on in front of them. And meanwhile, I'm down to rot gut wine. The big gallo, I don't know if anybody remembers these big gallo bottles that the glass was so heavy you needed two hands to move the bottle. I would be drinking that, but then I had a bottle of scotch under the kitchen sink with a straw in it, okay, because if you're a lady, you can drink wine, especially, you know, you can drink it alone. You've been cooking, you know, it's you know, and so I would have the wine going, and, you know, I knew I was changing as I took the drink. And I watched the kids change, and I watched the eyes. And I would stand at this island and pontificate. And then I would go from there to discussing their father's weaknesses with them. It just got really sick. And, you know, and I'd wake up in the morning, and I knew what I had done. And that's when I started with pouring the bottle out the next morning. And my kitchen sink drank more scotch than I did that last year, and it was a pitiful state. There, I don't have too many funny things in my, you know, some people in when they're giving their drunk-a-log, some funny things happened, and for some reason this morning I'm not remembering them. I'm really remembering the pain that I had and the pain that I inflicted, and that's what I need to remember, because when I start thinking that anything out of program, I'm in trouble. So one of my children that really carried the burden was my oldest one, because he started covering for me, and he's the one that became. And this, I've heard this happens a lot with an alcoholic and the oldest child. He became my solace. I would start telling him how awful, you know, and I'd be drinking and get really into the self-pity and disclosures that weren't even appropriate to discuss with a 16, 17-year-old son, kind of thing, you know, because I'm his mom, you know, I shouldn't be putting this burden on him. And I'll tell you today, that is a whole different relationship with that son. After I sobered up, I can remember he was bringing his wife. He and his wife were coming, and I think he was probably 26, 27. The year I sobered up, he went to college, so he did not live basically in the home with recovery in it. And I remember he was coming up with his wife, and he came in the garage door to the kitchen. And I watched this hulking, you know, 6'5", 220-pound guy, and he had eyes of a 5-year-old, and he's glancing around the house, the kitchen. And it took my breath away. I was, and I realized, when I made my amends with him, we talked about it, and I realized he was checking out the place to see which mom is there. Because he would either come home to a mom who had cookies and milk on the kitchen counter, and how was your day, and you're all wonderful students, or they'd come home to a rager, or someone in tears, or just a sick situation. And the more that happened in our house, and it happened for a while, the more I drank, because I couldn't really stand myself anymore. I wasn't even drinking. I was drinking for oblivion. There was no more have a couple of drinks. I wanted to black out. And because when I got in here, I didn't know I was having blackouts. I thought the alcohol was working, because take, you know, get me out of here. You know, just get me out of this situation. And my mom came to live by us, and I couldn't have her in the house because she knew, she lived with my dad, and she knew what was going on. So we found an apartment for her, and she became ill and subsequently passed away after a nasty illness. And it was during the time that she was ill that I started drinking every day. And I realize now, and in working the steps and all, that my powerlessness over her situation, over the hospital, over the doctors, anything. You know, I should have been able to take care of that woman. I should have been able to save her. And I'll be perfectly honest, I wasn't really fond of her either. But, you know, I loved her, but I didn't like her. We had one of those relationships. And but I just didn't know what to do about this. And I would, one time I went in and I told her I didn't want her, told them I didn't want her restrained. And because they had an NG tube in her and she kept pulling it out. So I went to the hospital that day and they had her restrained. And so my cure for that was to go home and grab a bottle. Now I'm drinking out of the bottle and go down into the unfinished basement and sit by the furnace and get drunk. And I remember, things had gotten so screwed up in my home, I remember my husband opening the door and saying, "Are you all right?" And I said, "No, but I will be in a minute." And he shut the door. I mean, he just, you know, did not, I mean, he didn't want anything to do with me. He had turned into a workaholic at this point. He, you know, he was away as much as he could be. And there's nothing, for me, there's nothing worse than a drunken mom, because the kids are hostage there. They're captured. You know, it's their home. It's where they are. And so my mom passed away, and my drinking then was very alcoholic. And it says in the big book that, you know, the different alcoholic 1, 2, 3, and the real alcoholic, you know, is, as I remember reading it, is someone who, when they take a drink, they don't know what's going to happen. They're, you know, and that's the point I was at. I had no idea what was going to happen. But I knew that I had a soul sickness, and I knew that I was desperate. I was just desperate. And I'd living in Cleveland, Akron area, you would think I would have heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. But back in 88, you really, you know, it wasn't out there. You know, there wasn't anything on television. There were no television shows about, you know, AA meetings, or there were no billboards about recovery. It just wasn't there. And but even where I'm living, I'm not hearing about it. And so I went on a retreat. It was 3 years after my mom passed away. I loved the name of it. That's what caught my attention. It's called Healing the Heart Within. Okay? That was right up my alley, because I, at that point, was such a drama queen that, you know, oh, my broken heart. Wasn't the alcohol. The alcohol was healing. You know, that was working for me. And at that point, and that week, I really drank, I think, maybe 24 hours a day. I don't remember, the week before I went on this retreat. And I got to the retreat house. It was March. It was in Cleveland, lots of snow on the ground. And I, at that point, couldn't go without a drink for a day. And I had taken a 2-liter bottle of Diet Pepsi and emptied it out and put this wine that I had, that's how far down I'd gone. I got to tell you something funny. In sobriety, I was standing in a grocery store, and they had the wine and the liquor up in the front of the store. And I'm looking at the liquor rack while I'm waiting in line, and I'm looking, and at the top, you know, you've got your Chivas Regal and, you know, all the really good scotches, okay, the Johnny Walker and the whole bit. And then you go down, and then you go down, and then you go down. At the bottom, there was Inverhouse, which I think cost $2 a bottle, okay? And I said, that was my drinking. I was, you know, when I started, I was drinking top shelf, and life was good. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was drinking the bottom shelf. And the symbolism of that to me, I might have been 4 or 5 years sober, the symbolism of that was, wow, I had no idea that, you know, I went like that. And so I got to this, back to the retreat, I got to this retreat and I had the bottle and I had rented a room that would be private, so because I knew I had to drink. And I got out of the car, and I need to preface this because this was a turning point. The night before was St. Patrick's Day. My husband and two of the children were in Scranton, Pennsylvania for a celebration. And the boys were carrying flags and had tuxes on and everything. And I had gotten my bottle of scotch because it was a celebration, so I would go for that, you know, rather than the wine. And I poured green food coloring into it. And think it's a green bottle, for God's sake. Okay, but I poured green food coloring into it. And I got a candle, and I got some cheese and crackers, because ladies always eat when they drink. And I got a tape of Danny Boy, because I was celebrating St. Patrick's Day. I'm Irish, you know, whatever. So I put on my best drinking bathrobe, and I go up into my room, and I lock the door, and I go into my walk-in closet, and I lit the candle in a closet full of clothes, okay? Lit the candle, got my drink, put on the Danny Boy tape, and, you know, I had a little party going. That this was my, you know, I'm fine. This, everybody does this, don't they? All right? And I was drinking, and for the first time that I could remember, I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober. I just, the wheels, all the committee in my head, the wheels, the voices, the demands, and the fears, and whatever, it wouldn't stop. And see, that was what alcohol did for me. It stopped all that, and it wouldn't stop. And I thought, I remember it, and I've heard it in these rooms 1,000 times. I just said, "Dear God, please help me. I can't do this anymore." And the phone rang, and it was my husband, and he was calling to tell me what a great job the boys had done and all, and they'd be home tomorrow. And I was drunk, okay, and I can remember trying to not slur my words. Something along the lines of, "I am so proud of them." I mean, something, I don't know if that's what I sounded like, but I remember trying to enunciate. And he just said, "I'll see you tomorrow," and hung up. And then, you know, I went to bed. I didn't know anything. And so, but I prepared my drink for the retreat and went out to the retreat house, and I opened the trunk of the car, and I had a brown paper bag, so I was drinking wine out of a brown paper bag, which, I mean, so I guess I qualify to be here. I didn't have a raincoat, but whatever, because that's what I thought was going on in here. And so I opened the trunk of the car to get my suitcase out, and I saw the bottle of wine, and this was a holy ground, okay, for me. It was a Catholic monastery and all, and I looked at the bottle, and I poured it out. You know, I poured it out, and it was such a symbolism for me as a Catholic. You know, I poured the red wine on the white snow, and all of a sudden, I realized that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And it's still very moving for me because I was so hungover. Oh my God, I was so hungover, but I just knew I was done. I knew I was done. I didn't know it when I filled the bottle with the wine. I didn't know it when I did the prep for getting a private room. I didn't know any of that, and I didn't even know it that night. But what happened to me is I walked into the retreat house. And there was a gentleman there who was facilitating. He was leading the whole retreat. And I know I'm terrified now, because once I poured it out, I thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to get through the night? You know, I mean, the panic. And I felt like I walked in there naked. I had no defenses. Okay, I had the one thing that kept me safe, the alcohol, I didn't have anymore. And luckily, I didn't have the idea to go get more, but that was God's work too. And in the course of that weekend, the gentleman that was facilitating it was a recovering alcoholic, and he shared his story. in increments as we did this retreat. And I started sobbing by Saturday afternoon, and I pretty much sobbed my way through till Sunday. And at the end of the retreat, we were leaving, and I'm a mess. I mean, I don't know what I'm, how I'm going to get home. I'm not capable of driving the car. I mean, I just... And he said, "Are you okay?" And having heard his story and him talking about the alcoholism and the effects it has on other people and all, it was more part of my sorrow. And I said, "I think I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "Okay," something like, I don't know exactly, but I know what I heard. And I said, "But I'm a woman alcoholic. I'm the lowest of the low." And because all I ever wanted in my life was to have a home and a husband and children. That's all I ever wanted. That's all I want today. You know, I mean, that was what I felt, and I was happy with it. See, alcohol just destroyed my dreams. And so I said, I'm a woman alcoholic, and I'm the lowest of the low. And he started to laugh at me. And when they say in the book that, you know, you're pouring your heart out to your sponsor and she starts laughing at you, this is my first opportunity to experience that wonderful experience of someone laughing at your sorrow. And but got me on track. And he said, "I think you'll find a few women." And he said, "You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And he gave me a meeting book. Well, I went home. And the next weekend at the retreat house, it was, I'm going to wind this up. Anyway, I had an experience of going on a retreat that dealt with alcoholism as a family disease. And that, to me, was my treatment. I did not go to treatment, but that two-day retreat following the one I was on really brought it home to me, the disease concept. And they did some skits with kids, you know, so I was dealing with my childhood and I was dealing with my kids' childhood and the whole bit. And but I didn't drink. I did not drink. I hadn't gone to an AA meeting, but I did not drink. So the next week I drove by some AA meetings, checking them out. But the car wouldn't stop. Okay, then finally I got in the parking lot on Thursday and just sat and watched. And people were out there smoking and all. And but they didn't look like me. You know, I didn't know I could belong. So the next morning was Friday, and there was a woman's meeting at 11 o'clock in the morning at church right in our neighborhood. And I went there, and I climbed the stairs. And I think there were 24 flights of stairs by the time, you know, in my mind. Every step was a flight of stairs. It was such, I can hear my feet, you know, on the stairs. And I got up there, and I heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't even know it. I heard the laughter and the gabbing, and there were some kids in there, you know, little ones, and it was a woman's meeting. And I looked in, I thought, well, this can't be, you know, AA. I mean, where are their hair, shirts, and whips, you know? And I walked in, and I said to someone, you know, this is my first meeting. And she, and I'm whispering to her because, oh my God, I've only told one other person, all right? And she goes, "We got a new one," you know? So I found out how joyful it is when we see a beginner in here, you know? And there it went. And I've never looked back. It's a love story for me coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I soaked it up. I drank up Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't get enough of it. And the funny thing is, two women from the meeting picked me up the next day and took me to a meeting. They did that for 2 weeks, so I got to go. And they introduced me around. And then they said, "Okay, we've shown you where to go. Now it's up to you." And the funny thing is, that solid 2 weeks, not one member of my family said, "Oh, Mom, please don't go. Oh, Mom, please don't leave. Where are you going tonight?" You know, none of that. It was like, whoa, peace in the house, you know. And I didn't understand anything when I got here. I loved the slogans, okay, the three or four words, you know, that they would say, because that I picked up on. But the steps, whatever, and... And I just had such wonderful teachers and such wonderful friends. And I hooked up with, when I was 2 years sober, I had one sponsor and she went out. But she was my convenient sponsor. We drank coffee, we talked about life, you know, where she got her clothes, you know, and you know, what her life was like, how's your job, and nothing about AA. And she went out. And so I was at a meeting and I said, you know, something about my sponsor went out, and this little redhead came over and she said, "I'm your sponsor now." You know, there was none of this going looking for a sponsor or whatever. Boy, she was right in my face. And that's what they did up there. You know, if somebody was new, you went in and said, "I will sponsor you temporarily," whatever. And she took me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 19 years before I moved down here. And the whole thing for me about Alcoholics Anonymous, once you put the drink down, is learning how to be in relationship with myself, my God first, myself, and then others. And my God had already worked a miracle for me. And I knew it. I realized it because I had not been without a drink or cleaning up after a drink or preparing for a drink. You know, I had the line of list of state stores that I'd done it on the computer, list of state stores, okay, and I would have check marks on which one I'd been to that week so I wouldn't go back because they might think I had a problem, okay? So I had like a 20-mile radius to go and get my booze. And, you know, I don't know where that came from because I lost my train of thought. But anyway, so I went through the steps and not as thoroughly as I could have. I had a tremendous amount of fear, tremendous amount of fear. And I find today that that's the hardest thing for me, is I am not free of fear after 25 years of sobriety. What I have developed is a faith that gets me through the fear. And one of my greatest fears was facing what I had been. And I didn't know if I did all this work, I'd be the hole in the donut. What if there's nobody in there? You know, what if there's nothing happening? And you know, and it tells us in the book that every person has a belief of some type of inner resource. Every child is born with one. And I remember my sponsor saying to me, "God is within, not without." And then that way, that's how she approached me on relationships in my life. That I either had somebody on a pedestal or buried them. Okay, somebody was either great or they were off. I was a woman of extremes. And the one I had the hardest time with was me. The shame, the guilt, the remorse that I walked in here with that has been lifted. I got to tell you, keep coming back. I never thought I could look in the mirror and see me. You know, just look in the mirror and be okay with what's going on behind my eyes. Because when I got in here, there was no light on in here. And I love that the parable about, you know, taking the bushel basket off your light. You know, because that's what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the steps, the fellowship, wow. I'd been escorted out of parties. You know, I had quit playing bridge. I had stopped all my committees. You know, I had isolated myself so much at the end of my drinking. And, you know, the fellowship to go, we'd go out for, go to an 8 o'clock meeting and then go out for coffee afterwards till midnight. You know, everybody had jobs or children or whatever, but that's what we did to stay sober. And I listened to what we call the war stories, things that people did that I did, things that people did that I didn't do but could have, you know. And they're laughing about them. Oh, let me tell you what I did, you know, kind of thing. And I'd been hiding behind so much shame and guilt and remorse and fear that what if I'm found out? And I walked in here and you're just like me. The book is just like me. Okay? I found out what I was. I was a sick woman that needed to get well, not a bad mother, bad wife, bad child trying to get good. That concept, the concept of the disease, has kept me back, coming back again and again and again. And because I understand, you know, I have some health problems. You know, I didn't ask for it, but I get through it by treating it, and that's what I do with my alcoholism. And I was, I know when I started sponsoring, that was such a, I just love sponsoring for what it gives me. Not for what I do, but for what it gives me. I walked in here this morning and I was reeling. I mean, my head was just doing dances and telling me what, you know, what I should say, what I shouldn't say, you know, rah, 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 rah. And I walked in and I talked to another alcoholic for 5 minutes. It's not about me. It's just not about me. And the ability to have a wonderful relationship with the God of my understanding. I had God in the box. Okay, I had him on Sunday morning, you know, I had him for holidays, I had him for showing up, and I believed. I had a faith, but I had a religion, and which for me confined my faith a little bit, and a lot. And when I got in here, the God of my understanding, learned all about your gods, and so I released mine. One of the ways I released my God out of that box, or out of, you know, to come out and stay, is the steps and all, but it was coming to terms with what I had done, what I was, what had happened, and knowing if I don't pick up a drink and I work the program, it doesn't have to happen again. It doesn't have to happen again. I put myself, when I was young, I put myself in dangerous situations. You know, if there was a party, I'd go to any length. And when I was reading about, we're going to a step study this afternoon, and we're doing step one, and I was reading it last night, and it said, are you willing to go to any length? Are you willing to go to any length? I am more willing today to go to any length than I was yesterday, or than where I was 4 years ago. I mean, when I was just cleaning up the wreckage of my past, which I'm still doing, I'm not through my amends, but when I was cleaning it up, you know, those first couple of years where you'd start putting your makeup back on and you should get cleaned up and you go to the grocery store and buy groceries and not bottles, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, that was what I had to do, and that's what we do. It's just, wow, there's a life out there beyond my pain and my guilt, and then I moved forward and then did some hard work, some really hard work. And, you know, it says if we are painstaking, it means it's going to be painful, some of the work we have to do. And, you know, and that's after step nine, that amends, oh, wow, not me. I'm just going to, my amends now is that I'm so nice. I'm so good. I'm the mother I should be, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to bring up that stuff in the past. It's over and done, you know. It doesn't work. It sits there. That's covering my God light, you know, that inner resource. And so the beauty is that I knew I couldn't do it alone, the amends. And I worked with my sponsor and my new sponsor now. I work on every time I do role playing on what my amends, what it needs to be, and keeping out of, yeah, but, you know, I did this, but, and knowing that I just cleaned my side of the street. And the outcome is what it is, and that has been working for me, it has. And you know the hardest has been with my children, the hardest. And I still have one I have to make, and he doesn't want to hear it, you know. But I haven't asked him in about 6 years, so maybe he's ready now. But he just said, "Mom, that's the past," and so I have to honor that. Because for me to push it to do so would injure them or others. I have to honor that he's not ready, and that's okay because I'm willing. And you know the honest, open, and willing is if I can do that half the time, I'm a winner. You know, some days if I just bite my tongue till it bleeds. Rather than take somebody down, because I can do it. Oh, that's the thing. You know, I came in here so nice. You don't understand. You know, I'm just so nice. I just drink. And boy, the discovery of the passive-aggressive behavior of the, you know, I'll get you first, or if you get me first, I'll get you faster, better next time. You know, all that. And sweetly, I mean, my mother, when foul language came into the house, my mother used to say, you know, you can insult someone with good English. You know, you can, and they'll walk away and not even know you've done it. All right. And so that would be, you know, where I was. I just, and an example, my husband, he doesn't hang his pants up the way I want him to. Okay. That was the issue. And he hangs them on a hook, his dress pants. And he wore suit and tie for work and everything. And so one time I walked into the closet and I've had it, this man, blah, blah, blah. And so I took all his pants that were on the hooks and dropped them on the floor. Well, it was pretty humid out, so everything wrinkled. And I see, and the thing is, I knew what was going to happen because I know him. And it blows me away that I think like this, but I do. So I dropped them all on the floor. Well, he sleeps in. There's another issue, all right? So, and he's got this meeting. And this is in sobriety. I mean, I'm like 10, 12 years sober. And I know he's going to be late. And so when he's in a late, he starts panicking. And I'm doing fine. I'm out getting breakfast and, you know, doing the whole thing. And he comes flying out the door. What time is it? And I told him the time. Oh, he said, boy, I'm going to be late. So he runs in, gets in the shower, and he goes in the closet. Okay? Picks up the pants. They're all wrinkled. Well, see, I'm nice, right? I'll iron them for you, honey. I'll take care of it. You get dressed. And meanwhile, I'm sitting here like the Cheshire Cat, you know, with this inner grin on my face. Got him. Where does that come from? Seriously, where does that come from? That's what I'm talking about in relationships. I could have gone in and awakened him. I could have not, you know, first of all, I could not worry about his pants, right, or him sleeping in. But when I'm doing those kind of things, I got something going on in here. Okay, I am not happy with me. So I'm going to make sure somebody else is unhappy. And I got to tell you, that instance, that was so eye-opening for me. I didn't share it with my sponsor because I didn't want to listen to her. But, you know, but it was such an eye-opener for me that now I started catching myself. Doesn't mean I didn't do some of the things, but I started seeing what it was. Today, I will tell you, I very seldom do those things. I still have that thought, I'll show you. You're not doing it my way, you will pay. And that thought can go through, but then what comes right after it is, we don't do those things. My sponsor used to say to me, the one up north, we don't do those things. Really? You know, she would. And we were working on Women's International up in Cleveland, and we were staying in the same room. And I remember her... We were in a hurry, I left the room, and she said, now turn around and look at the room. And I turned around and looked at the room. All right, yeah, okay, so. And she said, Alcoholics Anonymous members leave things better than they came in. Okay, we will be the only big book. And so we went back in, and I had to clean up my makeup and stuff, and I hung up my towel. I'd thrown it in the tub. I didn't think that was an issue. After my husband, but that really impressed me. Alcoholics Anonymous, we leave things better than we find them. We do not do those things, whatever it is, okay? The passive aggressiveness, whatever I brought to the table. We may be the only big book someone ever reads. And I need to know that, especially with the people I'm in, need to do that with the people I'm in relationship with. The damage I did, I cannot rectify, but I don't have to do it anymore. You know, it's a matter of today I am in relationship with my God, myself, and those about me to the best of my ability. And the glory is... the absolute glorious, I truly believe I am becoming the person my God intended me to be. And I will be forever grateful that I am an alcoholic, because I don't know if I could have learned any of this had I not gone down, down, down into an emotional hell. And I'm very grateful to be here. I love you all, and this has been an honor. Thank you.